can I welcome you this evening, and especially welcome Professor Ian Graham for coming up from Dublin. All the more so because he had a little bit of minor surgery this morning, so he's been very good to keep to his commitment this evening, and very much appreciate him coming to tell us something in the line of the standard that we have come to expect over the years for the Sir Thomas and Lady Edith Dixon lecture, which lecture has been endowed by those two individuals who probably have given more to the province than anyone else in Northern Ireland over the years. They were born at the end of the previous century. They both lived through both world wars. I'm not going to recount the various commitments and charitable donations that they gave, but of note, they gave Cairndhu, the current residential home at Larne, which at the beginning of the Second World War was actually given to the country as the voluntary hospital for the war depot of supplies for hospitals in Northern Ireland. They also donated one of their three Rolls Royces to be an ambulance. And then after Sir Thomas had died, Lady Edith gave, of course, the Rose Gardens where the Rose Trials are, Lady Dixon Park, and at the same time bequeathed a lecture to, she made several bequests to the Queen's University, but one in particular to the Royal, and it is this lecture that has been loosely connected thereafter to the Ulster Medical Society, which we're inviting Professor Graham to give us tonight. He himself has a string of achievements through his life. He's just recently retired from being person in charge of the Adelaide Hospital and in Tala, where he ran the cardiology service, I think, for many years. He has been Professor of Preventive Cardiology and Professor of Cardiology at Trinity and RCSI, and he is the chair of various European enterprises talking about cardiovascular prevention and management of the disease. So we look forward to hearing what he has to say this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Margaret. The minor procedure was a brain transplant, and it didn't actually take all that well, unfortunately. I have to say, I thought that I was just giving any old talk, and then I found it was the Sir Thomas and Lady Edith Dixon lecture, and I felt distinctly humbled, and I really do appreciate the very deep honour you've shown to me. And I didn't actually put in the slides I made on the history, which I was also sent, but they were the most formidable philanthropists. And I understand that he was a man, a farmer and a businessman with very much the common touch. I think she was wealthy in her own right, but they made so many endowments to the province, and particularly to hospitals and to medicine and to this lecture indeed. It's the kind of man you'd love to have met, because he sounds like a man with very much humility and the common touch. So I'm really grateful. I'm very grateful to Margaret. There's no way I was going to get out of this. I mean, she's one of these serious organisers. And I would have sat there. Well, I wouldn't be here. I'd still be having some wine over dinner. But no, wasn't it? Anyway, what I was going to look at was a little bit about the evolution of some of the current guidelines. I'll be talking a lot about the European ones, and I apologise for that in a UK audience, which is, in a way, in prevention, hardly part of Europe, but it's the bit I'm chairman of, it's the bit I know about, so I have to talk about that. A little bit about the future and which way it might be going, and I would also, talking about guidelines and guidance, I'd like to say a bit about implementation as well as the guidelines themselves, because when you get involved in guideline writing, you get this kind of glow of satisfaction, and you realise it's absolutely pointless, because precisely nothing will happen unless there's some strategy to do something about it. And that's the theme I'd like to develop as we go along. First problem is that many of you have probably seen the slide of the number of guidelines that family doctors get per year. It's about this high. And they're including the ones I was involved in, they're vastly too long, they're vastly too complex. And what's the point if risk factors are fairly common effects internationally and having American, Australian, Canadian, European, UK, Scottish, New Zealand, just to mention a few of them? What is the point in this plethora of incredibly turgid and complicated guidelines? And surely the theme should be to simplify the process and find the common ground people, there's a great review, I have to say, I just mentioned there, Richard Hobbs, a little book, a little monograph on cardiovascular risk management, and they tabulate all of these guidelines, and they don't actually quite finish the job by finding the common ground, but they do at least allow you to make the comparison, and it's a very nice resource, which is why I've given them. I was asked to review that, and at first I felt a little bit of professional jealousy. I thought, why are they doing this without me? It's a terrible thing to feel. And then it was rapidly replaced by admiration, because it's a great book. So, just by way of leading in, Europe, of course, is not homogenous, and the extraordinary events of the last 20 years, the switch of the gradient of vascular mortality from south to north to west to east, and you see all the black there around Russia, and more or less, as you get to Eastern Europe, is the social class gradient as well, not far off it. So it tracks social deprivation. And then how can we really make guidelines, one size that fits all, when you have a health expenditure of, say, 50 euros per head in Eastern Europe and 3,000 in Switzerland? It's very, very difficult. And we start talking about expensive medications that many of these countries have no way of affording. So one size does not fit all. And it is important, I think, that we encourage people to interpret whatever we waffle on about in the light of what is culturally appropriate. And again, that's another point we might touch on. There is, and I'm going to come back to the utter inertia of the European Union a little later on, but it was Geoffrey Rose who said that medicine and politics cannot and should not be kept apart, and that is surely true for a disease where the determinants of the disease are social, much more than anything else. At least we've got as far with the EU as getting the European Heart Health Charter signed by the vast majority of countries in Europe. And it advocates the development and implementation of comprehensive health strategies, measures, policies at European, national, regional, local level to promote health and to prevent it. And the European guidelines are actually endorsed in the European Heart Health Charter. So there is at least paper agreement, and it's been signed by lots of people. Whether that means action is a very different matter altogether. Well, the process, you're going to see this logo again, because first of several plugs, the EuroPrevent conference comes to Dublin in 2012, 3rd to the 5th of May, and the logo is based on this cycle. This is the way the kind of process works within the European Society of Cardiology. So hopefully the evidence base informs the guidelines. That's a waste of time without an implementation strategy. I happen to be chairman of the European PIC, Prevention Implementation Committee, as well. And then you need some kind of cycle of audit to measure what's happening, hopefully feeding back to the revision of the guidelines. The best-known audit is Eurospire, which is a formidably effective bit of work organised by David Wood, but it's only two hospitals per country, so it cannot be really representative, and it costs a lot of money to participate. Recently, we've launched a thing called eSurf, which is a 60-second audit you can do with a patient in front of you, and we've tested it. You can actually do it in 60 seconds, so we're now beginning to roll that out. That's a separate talk rather than tonight. We've tested it in four different countries in Europe and eight Asian countries. And it really is easy to use, so I'm hoping that will allow us slightly more representative audit data for the future. Well, that's the bit I've been involved in, because as chairman of the group that wrote these ones, and I have to tell you, there's plenty wrong with them. They're far too long, the evidence base isn't explicit for reasons that I'll come to in a minute, and I'm happy to say that they're now being revised. But at least Europe has been light years ahead of America in this process, where the Americans still have their separate panels, the National Cholesterol Education Program, the JNC for hypertension and so forth. They're more and more merging them. But at least from, we started this process in the mid-90s, and we tried to get the major players together to sit down. And we said, okay, you want to write your own specialist guidelines, that's fine, but please engage with us by making sure our joint guidelines are compatible with your specialist ones, which can be as detailed as you like. So it's the Society of Cardiology, the European Association of Prevention and Rehabilitation, Society of Hypertension, Behavioral Medicine, the Heart Network, Diabetes, Atherosclerosis Society, Diabetes Federation, Wankirch Family Doctors, and the Stroke Initiative. And then we have experts from heart failure, from renal diseases, and so forth. So the deal is, if you're going to participate, you will guarantee us that you will advise us enough that our joint guidelines are compatible with your specialist ones. which is working quite well on the new lipid atherosclerosis guidelines. It has not worked very well with hypertension. And anybody, many of you here, members of the European Society of Hypertension, before I speak out of turn? Well, it's a mafia. And it doesn't matter how much they tell us they're going to be compatible. They're not. But what can you do? We try. That is the deal. And we do our very best to encourage people. And I don't see the point in telling us to participate in this and then writing guidelines with a really complex risk estimation system, for example. There we go. So you'll be very relieved to know I'm not going to drag you through the contents of the guidelines. And again, you can see straight away, it's the usual introduction and how to evaluate and priorities, behaviour change, quite a lot on behaviour change, which I understand not at all, and then the individual components of risk, and then finally implementation strategies. This will be considerably compacted and shortened in the fifth task force. Well, one thing everybody needs to know is have some kind of definition of what is high risk to trigger whatever you're going to do about high risk. So in the European guidelines, high risk tracks the priorities because the highest risk people get the biggest benefit, at least as individuals. It's quite different from the so-called Rose paradox of a bigger global benefit, even though the individual gets much less benefit at community level. So, but for us, for those of us who are clinicians, people coming to see us as patients as opposed to groups of people, those who've had an event at the highest risk can get the biggest benefit. So they get the highest priority. Followed by asymptomatic people who are at high risk because they've got multiple risk factors, because they have diabetes, or because they have extremely high levels of individual risk factors, particularly, for example, hypertension with end organ damage. And then the bit that is clinicians, and those of you who are family doctors will be much better at this, how often we fail to check and advise the relatives of high-risk families, given that high-risk families are some kind of composite of shared environment and genetics, which needs to be, as far as one can, disentangled. So those are the priorities, but it's also the cascading level of risk. Just about every guideline now recommends total risk assessment. The reason being, of course, is that very, very high single factors like familial hyperlipidemia are rare, and in the vast majority of people, it's a composite of interlocking risk factors, which react in very complicated ways, but sometimes multiplicatively. So, well, they all have some kind of pecking order like that, but apart from that, all the current ones have some kind of risk scoring system. And this is where some of our problems begin. So in Australia, it's a 5-year risk of cardiovascular disease over 15%. Canada, CHD risk over 20%. Europe, odd man out, fatal cardiovascular disease over 5%. That's not popular. That's not a popular way of doing it. People don't like it, and I'll come back to that. UK, mostly Framingham-based, 10-year over 20%. America, CHD over 20%, all CVD in some of the new revisions. New Zealand, CHD 20%, International Atherosclerosis Society 20%. But what does this 20% mean? And it means just about nothing, as we'll see in a minute, unless you know exactly how it's defined. Well, the one I've been responsible for is the so-called SCORE project. Whether it's good or it's bad, it's big. It's based on 12 European population samples, nearly all representative population samples, 205,000 people, compared with Framingham, which is much more homogenous, but is including the offspring study, 8,000 people, ProCam about 8,000 people. So it's very big, whether it's good or bad. And it's heterogeneous, so it's quite representative of Europe, as far as we can tell, but it's very crude. It's very crude. And as many of you will know, you just find out which box you live in. So you've got men, women, smoker, non-smoker, blood pressure vertically, different ages, cholesterol horizontally, and that's your 10-year risk of a fatal cardiovascular event. And that's for the high-risk areas of Europe. Obviously, with the changes in mortality, you have to... the definition of what's high-risk will be changing. And, of course, all risk charts will overestimate risk in a population where risk is dropping, like Western Europe, and underestimate risk in Eastern Europe where it's rising. That's just the nature of the beast. And you deal with that by recalibration, as we'll see. And of course, there are problems with it, apart from the simplicity. Where is your favourite risk factor? Where's LP little a? Where's fibrinogen? Where's homocysteine? Where's CRP? It actually doesn't matter. The additional effect of all the clever new risk markers is very, very, very small. And again, that's a different talk. It also gives you the misleading impression that women are at lower risk than men. That's wrong. That's a fallacy. Actually, more women than men die of cardiovascular disease in Europe. They just do it later. So what you get by virtue of being female is a 10-year holiday. So a 60-year-old woman in terms of risk is practically identical to a 50-year-old man. So it's merely a deferral. You don't escape it. And I think that's really quite an important message. There's also the problem that all these people, certainly women, young-ish, middle-aged women of 40, are at low risk. That's the truth. But that may conceal a very high relative risk. This is approach with absolute risk. And to deal with that, there are a number of approaches. Originally you said, well, extrapolate to age 60. So this guy is only 4% risk, but by the time he's 60, he's 32% risk. And that seemed to us quite sensible. We got beaten up by the Europeans who interpreted it very literally, as we were going to prescribe drugs to every young person. And we never meant that. We just said, flag somebody who will need intensive lifestyle advice and may need drugs. But maybe our English wasn't clear enough. So we've dealt with that with a relative risk chart that I'll show you in a moment. But for the fifth joint guidelines, we'll do what will probably happen in the UK as well. And we will also express it in terms of risk age. For example, and we've just submitted a paper publication with a new formula for calculating risk age, but you don't actually need it. You can see it. So this 40-year-old man who's got a blood pressure of 180 and a cholesterol of 8, 4% risk, not that impressive, but he is the same as a 65-year-old man with no risk factors, also 4%. So in other words, his risk age is 65. And that's quite a good way of expressing risk. The electronic version of this is called HeartScore, and you can get it at the ESC website, escardio.org, and that allows you, it calculates it for you. There's more functionality going in. We're now putting in HDL cholesterol and body mass index, and it gives you automatic printout of patient advice, and it brings you into the guidelines if you can't quite remember what the guidelines say. So that's, as I say, that's being upgraded at the moment, and it's working. And in some European countries, like you can in the UK, you can get into HeartScore automatically once you've entered your patient's data. There's also cholesterol HDL ratio versions of this chart, and we got that all wrong. The ratio does very little; it performs very little better than total cholesterol. And we slowly worked out that that's because it's driven by the cholesterols, a much wider spread of cholesterols. And with the new electronic version, when you put in HDL, it doesn't alter the performance of the risk prediction very much, but it does reclassify people. So if you have a low HDL or a high HDL, it will shift your risk category quite appreciably. We've also been re-looking at other simple things. We re-looked at body mass index. And it's more powerfully related to risk than we had realized. We kind of underestimated it. And a bit like social class, it's very much a driver of other risk factors. So body mass index is very much a driver, more strongly than we realized. Having the size of score, there have been 3 or 4 huge papers in BMI in the last couple of months, and it's been kind of rediscovered. And whereas HDL works at every age, and actually quite strongly in elderly women, which is a big surprise, body mass index is very much more powerful predictor of risk in young people. When I think of the number of middle-aged women I've nagged about their weight, I feel thoroughly guilty, because the lowest risk in women over 60 is in the mildly obese. So, wrong again. It just shows when you go back and look at the simple things how much there really still is to learn. And we've also made an even simpler risk chart based on age, gender, seeing it drives cholesterol and blood pressure, age, gender, smoking, and BMI alone, and it actually performs quite well. So if you go from a body mass index, for example, from 20 to 30, which is a big jump, of course, that's worth nearly half a millimole of cholesterol after adjusting for everything else. It's associated with a fifth of a millimole reduction in HDL, and it's associated with an 11 millimeter increase in blood pressure, just purely from the weight alone, at least in younger people. So it really is quite a powerful. That's not to say a middle-aged person who is fit and slightly overweight is probably the lowest possible risk, but in younger people, and of course, what's young, we need to see how far back towards childhood BMI works. That's the lowest part of Europe, and that's the relative risk chart. We stopped using the colours on this because it confuses people, but what this is saying is that nearly, certainly in younger people, young to middle-aged people, even if your absolute risk on the chart is only 2 or 3%, your relative risk may be 12 times higher.
So this person might have an absolute risk like that 40 or 94%, but it's 12 times higher than it needs to be if they had an optimal risk profile. So these are the options we're trying to develop as a way of counselling tools with our patients to say, you're young, you're at low absolute risk, but look where you'll be at age 60, look at the fact you're 12 times higher than you need to be, and look at your risk age, it's 25 years older than you need to be. These are the kind of ways we're trying to explore making this kind of stuff accessible. It's interesting at the risk charts. I talk in schools a bit, and school kids understand that instantly. You just give them a remote idea of what blood pressure and cholesterol is. They understand those risk charts incredibly well. And because they're not... The challenge, I suppose, for us is to demedicalize this. Not to be so paternalistic about it. But if you can get the concept across, perhaps, well, actually, it's your risk, and you can choose whether you want to adjust it as you get older or not. It's not my risk, it's yours. Maybe then we'll stop thinking it's a medical problem and accept that it's a societal and a political problem. So why are our score charts out of line with everybody else in using fatal cardiovascular disease? Now, I've had to defend this many times. Well, what we did is that we took all the ICD, International Classification of Disease, codes, and we took out all the ones that were clearly not atherosclerotic, congenital heart disease, stuff like that. So it's a hard and a reproducible endpoint. We have spent a lot of time looking at the multiplier for total events. And if you want a multiplier for total hard events, unequivocal strokes and myocardial infarctions, it's about threefold. Slightly higher in young people and slightly lower in old people, where, of course, their first event is more likely to be fatal, so the ratio, the multiplier won't be so high. We've done that working with the FinRisk collaborators, where they have very well-defined endpoints, and that's reasonably robust. But one particular point, if you stick to cardiovascular mortality, is you can recalibrate. And the recalibration process allows you to calibrate for changes in mortality over time and changes in risk factors over time. So if these charts are 10 or 15 years old and you have up-to-date mortality figures and up-to-date risk factor data, you can recalibrate. And when you test it, it works very well. It works nearly as well as making a new chart on that population, which you can't do for non-fatal events because of their instability. You can't recalibrate for total events easily. And the problem with non-fatal events to me is that they're very unstable. They vary over time. They're not stable. And they're very hard to reproduce. So it depends which non-fatal events you choose. Do you want something soft like angina, or do you want unequivocal myocardial infarction? It depends on the definition, and it depends on the diagnostic techniques. For example, troponins have totally and completely altered both our definition and our way of diagnosing myocardial infarction. So how do you allow for that if you want a total event chart? And it depends on the ascertainment. How well have you ascertained them? How hard have you tried to ascertain the events? So all these charts are 20% CHD or CVD risk. It's meaningless unless you know how it's defined. And I have to justify that. And this is Catherine McGorry's thesis. I'm not going to particularly show you the data. But the point is that, for example, they're mostly based on the 1998 Framingham function. But there are actually four different Framingham functions, different techniques, and subtly different endpoints, hard endpoints, soft endpoints. And if you start off with the 1998 Framingham function, 20%, then you put the same risk factors into the other four Framingham functions, you get results of anything from about 16% to 40%. So unless you know which function has been used, and there's another one for PROCAM and many others, unless you know which function has been used and what endpoints have been chosen, it doesn't have a great deal of meaning. So we are sticking with our mortality charts. We will publish the multiplier and all the problems with it. And the point of Catherine's thesis has been to... Everybody thinks it's easy. They think, oh, well, I see many more non-fatal events than fatal events. The multiplier's got to be such and such. It's not easy. It's very complicated. The other problem is with total events or with non-fatal events is that all risk estimation systems terminate at the first event. They don't count the subsequent events. So when you think you see far more non-fatal events, they haven't got counted. So it ain't that easy. Well, everybody wants targets. You get so trapped when you're dealing with European stuff, because some European countries don't like the word targets because they feel many patients won't get to them and then there'll be a kind of a failure. So the term is the characteristics of the healthy European. That's Euro jargon for target, okay? And to try and help us to remember it, we have this kind of telephone number. It's nearly a palindrome. So the zero is zero tobacco. The three is exercise, 30 minutes or 3 kilometres a day. Five portions of root and vegetables. Blood pressure under 140. Cholesterol under 5. LDL under 3. And avoidance of overweight and diabetes. And healthy people tend to be like that. But for the high-risk people, all risk estimation systems, including European ones, have more stringent targets. So for high-risk people, the blood pressure target is 130. Now, recent work in diabetes suggests maybe that's actually too low, so we're not sure if that's right. And then there's two for the high-risk people, cholesterol 4.5 and 4, and LDL 2.5 and 2. That 4.5 and 4, is and 2.5 and 2, is if feasible. So in other words, 2.5 anyway, but if your budget and your abilities and your culture allows you to get to 2, that's regarded as being more or less ideal. Well, actually, if you look at the international ones, the targets don't differ that much. It might be LDL or cholesterol targets, but they don't actually differ all that much, and I've tabulated it here. Now, when there's two figures, like in Europe, that's if feasible. For other people, the subcategories of risk, the people with more severe disease, at the top of target. But what's nice about that slide is that there is actually, given these huge, gigantic, cumbersome guidelines, the targets are not that different. And that's where we should be going, is parsing the guidelines, saying, yes, oh, fine, I've read the 1,800 references and the 622 pages, but actually, the take-home messages are not that different. And they're arising out of that, again, do we need all these different guidelines? I think it's relevant that Europeans and Australians and New Zealanders read American guidelines, and Americans never read anything. If it wasn't born in America, it doesn't exist. There are notable exceptions to that. There are several American major publications where they put in European risk charts because they actually like them better, but it is the exception. And for blood pressure for high-risk people, it's somewhere between 140, 90, 130 over 80, and with more aggressive goals than those with clinical cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and renal disease. So again, if you're not going to fuss too much about whether you're going a millimetre here or there, the degree of concordance is not that bad. So it is possible to try and simplify the take-home messages. And I think if we can do that, we have some hope of making the implementation easier. Well, the fifth joint task force has started under Jörg Perk's guidance now, and I'm very pleased to be on it, and even more pleased not to be chairman, and I have to say he's doing a better job than I did, because we are learning. They'd be considerably shorter and more succinct, you'd be relieved to know. We've had a big debate on the evidence base, and I don't quite know the answer. The European Society of Cardiology uses the same system as the Americans, and you're probably familiar with it, and it quite appropriately gives the highest grading to robust meta-analyses and multiple randomized controlled trials. That's fine, except it's a guarantee of more drugs. And that's where we got stuck. And we refused, to the annoyance of the ESC in my guidelines, we refused to use it. We said, well, all right, you want us to consistently give a higher grading to blood pressure drugs and statins than you do to lifestyle or nutrition or exercise or stopping smoking, which has, of course, a bigger effect than any statin. What do we do? How can we resolve this? And they said, stop annoying us, just use our grading. So he said, no grading. Well, we're now, for the present ones, we are doing that, but we're also comparing it, having looked at some of the grading, with the World Health Organization grade system, and those of you who know about that, it's a bit complicated, but the end result is not exactly, not just the quality of the science, it's a do it, don't do it decision. So you have do it, probably do it, probably don't do it, and don't do it for a harmful thing, which would be grade 3C or whatever in the European nomenclature. And maybe that's, again, a little bit more practical. So I've always said we will be addressing risk estimation. We'll have more on the multiplier to convert from mortality to total events. We'll be looking at this concept of risk age and how to express it in more detail. And in the new version of the electronic version of HeartScore, you'll get a risk age automatically if you want it. Targets will be similar. We might have a really dramatic seismic shift from 2 to 1.8 millimoles for high-risk people to be in line with the new lipid guidelines. The reason, and there is time for feedback, so any thoughts you may have, give them to us. And what I'm really delighted about, normally the prevention guidelines get launched at the main ESC conference, which is in Paris this year, and I forget where it's Stockholm, where it is next year.
But there's a cascade effect. The present lipid guidelines are delayed, and they're delayed because they were awful. The lipid guidelines were written by lipidologists who wanted endless, endless pages of minutiae, and you can't find a guideline anywhere in them. And they've had to be totally and completely rewritten under Guy de Backer's guidance, and they're quite good now. But that's had a cascade effect in preventing, in delaying the joint guidelines, which would have been launched in Paris this year, but now get delayed to Europe events in Dublin next year. And I'm hoping this will attract all the allied healthcare professionals and family practice, not just the cardiologists, to the meeting. So that's my second plug. There's one more coming. Well, good guidelines, good for the vanity of the authors and bad for rainforests. I mean, you really do feel rather pleased when it comes out of print. I mean, it's, you pick it up and you touch it and it feels great. Nothing happens, of course, because why would it? It's just a load of paper. So hence the various implementation endeavours, like our European Prevention Implementation Committee. And this is where it gets a bit boring and a bit difficult. Well, of course, you've got to know it's in the guidelines. You need to know the gap, what audit information is available. You'd like to know about the barriers and strategies to improve it, and you'd like to know how you're going to coordinate the many players. Well, that's fine, but this process from here on gets less and less evidence-based. And what gives me nightmares about my Prevention Implementation Committee is that I don't know what to do. I don't know what's effective, and I don't know how to measure the effect. I mean, if mortality is changing, that's great, but was it anything to do with what you've done? It's a nightmare. And then when you start to look at what's happening at European level, it is like herding cats. The EU should be vital, but they're a waste of space. There is no legislative framework for health within the European Union. There is for food safety, but not for health. So all they can do, I mean, it's nice to have a high health charter, but again, it's more words. And we had a conference at the European High House in Nice in November about closing the loop between science and political action. And the EU guy there gave us the same old waffle that he's been giving us at every of the conferences for the last 5 years. And just for once, he got named by Lars Rieden, who's been the liaison person, who pointed out to him they'd actually done nothing. It is difficult for them because there isn't a legal framework, and the individual departments of health really don't want the EU telling them what to do very much. So, but until they have some kind of legal teeth, the EU, bearing in mind that the EU should have carried a government health warning, and what do? They promoted tobacco in large parts of Europe because of the cash crop in poor areas, and they've promoted saturated fats for years. So they're only now beginning to get the semblance of a social conscience and to think about health, but it's been a particularly ineffective social conscience so far. Then there's the specialist bodies, ESC, our own Association of Prevention and Rehabilitation. Then you've got the National Cardiac Societies, the other specialist bodies, the GP societies, the Ulster Medical Society. Then you've got the allied health professionals, the educators, and the industry, which could be working either way. Well, tobacco may have shifted appreciably to destroying Asia, but it's still around. Food, of course, is very much around, with these monstrous portion sizes and the global epidemic obesity. The pharmaceutical industry, let's not knock them, maybe they're not supporting this meeting, but they support 95% of the meetings in the South, but they've got their own agenda. And then some of them might be good, like maybe Nike and Adidas could be regarded as more benign than those that might be neutral. So how does anybody make a picture out of all these competing influences in a kind of coherent way that's effective? It's just not easy. And this is from Ulrich, my friend Ulrich Kyle. Said is not heard, heard is not understood, understood is not agreed upon, agreed is not applied, and applied is not at all maintained. And that's guideline implementation in a single phrase. Well, what about the gap? Well, this is where everybody would have seen the next slide on EuroPrevent. And EuroPrevent, you will recollect, is David Wood's audit of risk factor management, and it's in people with established vascular disease who survived for 6 months. So they're the people we should do best in, because they're the highest risk people attending doctors, attending GPs, attending hospitals. As I said a little earlier on, it may or may not be representative. It's two hospitals per country, and having done it twice, I'm not sure if I can bear to do it again, because it costs you two nurses' salaries for a year and a half to participate, and very little help. But it's a bit gloomy in a way. It's telling you that statins work. Well, is that really an advertisement for the polypill? It's a bit scary. Tells you that even though blood pressure medication has gone up, blood pressure control has not improved. And that's maybe where we do need a sort of a polypill, because antihypertensive treatment is nothing like statins. Statins do exactly what they say on the can. Blood pressure medication doesn't. But our old friend John Feely, who sadly died recently, he made the first blood pressure polypill, and it was a quarter dose of calcium antagonist, a thiazide, a beta blocker, and an ACE inhibitor, and it had a phenomenal effect on blood pressure in his initial studies. So combination therapy, even though it's against what we were taught in pharmacology, is presently probably the way hypertension is going.
But then gloom and doom. Obesity, that may be a large reason why the blood pressure controls are difficult. Diabetes going the wrong way, parallel obesity. BMI going the wrong way, and smoking hardly changing. So how badly we've done in controlling what's happening with lifestyle. And this is not a judgment, or it may be more a judgment on the food industry than it is on people. With the portion sizes and the high density calorie foods being almost force fed into children, and the cleverness of supermarkets where they put the goodies at small child's eye level height on the way out of the checkout, and so on and so on and so on. So it is a huge challenge. Might be bad here, just wait till you see what's going to happen in China and India. It is happening, because they do not appear to tolerate putting on weight at all well. I've been out to China several times recently. In Beijing, might be pure chance, but there is a direct linear correlation between the number of McDonald's outlets and the increase in body weight in Beijing. There are now 1,000 McDonald's outlets, and 15 years ago there were none. Maybe chance. The tobacco and smoking, they're still in China advertising tobacco as being good for health for athletes, like they used to 50 years ago in America. In one province in China, the governor passed a law that every adult must smoke. True, because it was the only cash crop in the area. Now, even that nobody likes being laughed at. He did lose his job, but that is not even fiction. 312 million Chinese men smoke, and they do not tolerate putting on weight. So they are facing a devastating epidemic, and you have to be very careful in China saying this. You don't understand the culture very well, and there's a slight culture of, so we've already got 1.3 billion people. If we lose 1 million, is that so bad? You know, it's kind of complicated. Well, there's a fair literature, mostly based on questionnaires, so it's hard to know how scientific it is, on barriers to implementation. And again, many of you know this, relating, and again this is a different talk where we look at all these settings relating to the person, the position, the healthcare setting, and community and society. And indeed, we did our own, I'm not sure if it's science, we did an actual market research survey on why people don't do prevention a few years ago. And the REACT study of Richard Hobbs and Leif Erhardt is quite well known. And that's compacting a lot of information. This is very judgmental, I suppose, adherence, or the degree to which my patient's behaviour coincides with my advice is the politically correct way of saying it. But of course, there's again a big issue on compliance. And if we talk rubbish, it's going to be hard for them to comply. If we give them 17 medications when they're 80 years old, it's hard to comply, and so on and so on. They can't afford it. And we well know that many people's many statin prescriptions cease to be filled after 2 years. Virtually every physician says, look, I don't get enough time. I simply don't have enough time. And the future, certainly in many countries, is, I'm quite sure, the allied health professionals. Many of our experiences are that nurses do it more reliably, more obsessionally, and are nicer to the patients than we are. Well, at least in the UK, there is some financial incentive, if I understand it right, which may have been effective. But in most healthcare jurisdictions, you get paid to treat ill people. You do not get paid to keep people healthy. Problem. Guidelines, are they clear? Complicated, confusing, too much information, too general, don't fit my patient? And is government policy helpful, or is it passively hostile in terms of helping you, paying you, helping the patients? So the same surveys say what would help the guideline usage, the inverse of what I just said. Well, simple, clear, credible national guidelines. We actually found that people, with the European guidelines, we don't say to people, please, please use our guidelines. We say, why don't you make them Northern Irish? Well, you have the own UK guidelines. Why don't you make them Swedish? Why don't you make them Slovenian? Just take them and modify them, and then people rather like their national guidelines. So we would very much encourage people not to just... In the South, we have adopted the European ones. We've endorsed them, but and many other countries have. But if people want to change them, great. Obviously more time, facilitatory government policy with an actually defined prevention strategy. In the South, we had a very good prevention strategy, but it's sort of withered away in the last couple of years. It's gone backwards. Reimbursement for health professionals and public awareness, and this whole thing of
in the jargon, empowering, making the information accessible. Why shouldn't it be part of the curriculum? If you know geography, why shouldn't you know your chances of being dead in 30 years' time? What's wrong with knowing about it? And some kind of implementation strategy, and I'm going to say a few more words on this, but if it's just another committee, let's set up a committee. You know, it's a bit like writing a guideline. You feel you've done something useful. So we've written a bit on this, trying to work out what you might do about it. And this is a bit of waffle, and then I'll finish. At European level, well, of course, you've got to publish the things. We've made a prevention toolkit, which is readily available to anybody who wants it. It's now electronic. It's on a CD. It has the guidelines, paper and electronic, posters, heart score, slide kit, a dissemination strategy, an implementation grouping, and I'll come back to that, presentations at meetings, and lobbying, and again lobbying. Eventually, the EU will start to take health policy seriously. And the ESC has engaged in this very much more vigorously in the last couple of years, I'm glad to say. So the tools, then we have the guidelines, we have HeartScore, the electronic version, which you can either work with online, which allows you to store the information, or you can download it onto your desktop and have it available to you. We've developed a new guideline learning tool, and this is an interactive case-based learning that we've just finished piloting. And if you do the online version, you can get, or will be able to get, accreditation, get credits for it. Because once you've registered, you're automatically logged in. And if you go through the whole thing, it's case-based. So although it has a little bit about general principles and about, but mostly it's 14 case histories that you interact with, and it brings you in. It's got all sorts of little tweaks in it, like it'll bring you into the risk charts, it'll tell you how to calculate risk, and so on and so on and so on. And then there's the e-toolkit that contains these, and then SURF, I've already mentioned to you, which is the simplified audit that we're doing. So at national level, then, after we encourage the adaptation of the European guidelines, the formation of multidisciplinary implementation groups, and multifaceted communications, all very generic. I mean, those are pretty obvious principles in a way. So we've asked the National Cardiac Societies to nominate national coordinators, and to develop the national guidelines, the partnerships that are necessary, the communication strategy, but it needs political access. And in some countries, the cardiac society has appointed somebody and they just wanted the title, nothing happened. So we're now suggesting two national coordinators, a cardiologist and one from the Department of Health. And in the south, actually, we have, I think he's probably not going to go on doing it, but we have Mahan Varma from Enniskillen to provide some kind of coordination and to advise us. And we have Siobhan Jennings, because she is in the health service executive and has direct access to the politics. So that's, I hope, will work. That doesn't matter. So at European level, we established the Prevention Implementation Committee, and the ESC has asked the association to do this, and that's the purpose of my Implementation Committee. It's the president of the ACPR and the various worthies, and then the section representatives, but that's just trimming. And we, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, we've defined our core activities, our strategies, and our activities with the national coordinators, and we have regular meetings with them. And the core activities is a benchmarking project. Again, why do people do it and why don't they do it around Europe? What Hannah McGee has found in many European countries, you cannot find at government level who is responsible for prevention. There isn't anybody, or if there is, they're well hidden. And there's a lot more in her work than that. We're doing health economic modelling, based a bit on Eurospire, to try and see what's most effective. We have several demonstration industry projects. I'm leading this SURF simple audit thing. We're doing if you Google implementation strategies, you get about 3,000 hits, but it's all waffle. It's just generic principles. Political lobbying, Lars Reden, he's now been succeeded. A how-to manual, which is like standard operating procedures for prevention, which I think might be much more practical value than the guidelines. And then we're working a bit on lay communications. We're doing a lay version of SCORE so that you can make it easier to assess your own risk. And that's being partly run by Jörg Perk in pharmacies in Sweden, which will help you to go through the risk for yourself. So I'd like to draw to a conclusion, if I might. Guideline development is becoming more sophisticated, but the grading of evidence, as I've indicated to you, I just think it needs more debate. And it's been very hard to get the ESC to even undertake that debate. They just said, we've got a system, it's the same as America, it's fine. Well, it's not fine.
This is incredibly resource intensive, and in America and to some extent in the UK, there is money available for systematic reviews. In the ESE, there is not, and I don't think we'd expect people to go on giving up weeks and sometimes months of their time every year. It's lovely to participate in the process, but there's a very heavy price to pay. My own feeling is there's far too little international debate and discussion about this. And as I said, I really don't understand the need for 6, 8, in fact, well over 100 prevention guidelines. I've just picked out the top 6 or 8. And surely we should focus on finding the common ground, as long as the common ground is evidence-based. And as I said, at least for the targets, it's much more agreement than you would think at first. If you go looking for differences, you'll find them. If you go looking for similarities, they are there. There's still a huge gap between the guidelines themselves and the practice. And implementation is not well evidence-based because it's very hard to study. It's really hard to randomise controlled trials and implementation strategies. It's very, very difficult to do. And then the EU, as I've said, and I've said it to them as well, so I don't mind, is largely inert, and the lobbying needs to continue at every level, at Northern Irish government level, and Republic government level, and at EU level. So I thank you. My third plug is to come to Europe. Print. Thank you very much indeed for and again, I feel honoured. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Could I invite some questions to this master of the management of complexity, I think, that we've seen in relation to cardiovascular disease across the world, and particularly in Europe? I know we've cardiologists and we've general practitioners in the audience, and perhaps they're coming from the different sides of the same perspective. Anyone would like to, or could I ask you a question to start with? What do you think is the most important aspect of implementing prevention in cardiac disease?
I suppose, we have to accept that most hospital cardiologists really want to blow up balloons and not be annoyed with talking to people too much. So that puts family practice on the agenda. And I suppose the simple observation that 80% of people visit their family doctor over a course of 2 years. So I think as a really simple approach to use every possible opportunity, especially if somebody's a smoker or a middle-aged man, to assess risk. So maybe opportunistic approach is the simplest. It's grand to say you must assess everybody's, but unless there's a financial incentive to do it, it's not going to happen, is it?
Thanks very much, Ian, for that great talk. Just on that point about general practice, we have a plethora of tools available to us, certainly in UK general practice, at our computer, at our desk, with the patient beside us. And you know, just at the touch of a button, you can calculate a patient's risk factors based on Framingham data, or you can choose to base it on JBS guidelines. And it comes up with a very confusing conflict. For example, in the same patient, you might get Framingham data predicting 7% or 5% risk of a coronary event in 10 years. And on the same patient, you get JBS coming up with 29%. So
that's exactly the point.
What is this? What do we do with the patient sitting right beside us, and with you having a look at this, and be quite clear to the patient the conflict between those two seemingly expert guidelines?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point of this 20% being a sort of mythical figure. I mean, the first Framingham function included non-specific chest pain in women, for example, whatever that is. The last one is hard, reproducible cardiovascular events. Although I don't really like to promote relative risk, it is relatively robust. Within the different systems, relative risks will be rather similar, and risk age looks as if it's almost independent of the system used to estimate risk and of culture and of country. And that means you don't even have to recalibrate. So I think if one really doesn't know what to say of the absolute figure, to say, well, to go, it's reasonable to use the relative risk and say, well, look, your risk is actually high enough, and it's 10 times higher than it needs to be, or your risk age is 25 years older than it needs to be. That's part of an answer to the dilemma. Otherwise, you've got to be an expert in all the different algorithms to say, well, it's 10% here and 20% there, and the reason for that is that this one's including all the soft endpoints.
Yeah,
So it that's a partial answer.
So in a way, these tools can be counterproductive just in general practice.
And our score, you know, because it's fatal events, you say your risk is 4%. Now, that might be very high, but that means, well, wait a minute, that's 96% chance I'm not going to die? That's fine. So they can. Yeah. But I think to get maybe familiar with one tool is usable, and then the relative risk and the risk age.
Carol, Ian,
I
enjoyed that tremendously, and I apologise for blowing up balloons occasionally. First of all, I commend you on trying to reduce the volume of the guidelines, and if you'd like to talk to all the other ESC groups, that would be very helpful as well. But if you were a health autocrat with a limited budget, where would you put your resource? Would you put your resource into the reduction on a population basis or onto looking for specific high-risk individuals?
Yeah, well, that's a clever question because that's Geoffrey Rowe's. Well, the best value would be to let the high-risk people die as quickly as possible, because in terms of less dead bodies, you get a far bigger impact from a community-wide, very small change in risk applied to the whole community. That is, so the individual gains less. The paradox, the individual doesn't gain very much, but the community gains more, and that's the whole nature of the paradox. So in other words, to have a high-risk strategy only would be a dismal failure. You want both, but if it had to be more one or the other, it would be the community strategy. And as an invasive epidemiologist who's only just stopped blowing up balloons, I do have a sympathy.
Just to tell you a story for a short time. I once, by chance, found myself in Framingham on a wet night like this, and wondered about getting something to eat.
You couldn't even get a pint.
10 o'clock at night in Framingham, it is almost impossible to find anything to eat except the local chippy. And in the local chippy, I got an enormous meal of all the wrong things, full of fat, food, everything else. But the really frightening thing about Framingham was that nobody spoke English. They all spoke Spanish. And therefore, it was quite difficult to find your way around in Framingham. So I wonder what the actual Framingham population is now. It's certainly not what it was 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, because it was...
One question.
Yes, sir.
Second question really is, and then my real question is, I come from the background that thinks that cardiovascular disease, bless its heart, is a subset of diabetes, rather than the other way around. So looking at the world through the diabetes spectrum, we would like to think that there is a difference, what Carol was saying, between what the public health doctor thinks the population should have as their normal blood sugar and what the individual family doctor would think their particular patient should have. Should there be different guidelines for public health people for countries and for actually what you do at the desk?
Yes. Well, regard to Framingham, it was, of course, very much Caucasian, relatively well-educated, and that certainly has been diluted. But they're still studying the first-generation offspring, which is probably less diluted. And yes, there should be certainly different... I mean, the targets are aimed at the level of baseline risk, and that's why they're more rigorous for the diabetics and high-risk people. So absolutely there should be different targets and different, I'm not sure, different guidelines, but certainly different targets for healthy people than, say, diabetes. And your point about diabetes is of course well made, but there's a common substrate, isn't there, of risks, and a huge, this idea, we have a new chronic disease management program, and it is nonsense, because it's silos. It's diabetes, and it's chronic lung disease, and it's coronary disease, and it's stroke. In other words, it's salvage stuff, and it doesn't recognize the common substrate. But anyway, to get back to your point, different targets and guidelines for individuals, absolutely agree.
I agree with you, the confusion and the European confusion with the definitions. I was a delegate on the European Cancer Control Commission, and the French delegate wouldn't agree that beer and wine were alcohol. And it was only many years later that I discovered that the French alcool refers exclusively to spirits and hard liquor. But the same thing seems to be true with alcohol and cardiovascular disease. We keep getting contradictory messages.
Yeah. I wonder about this red wine stuff. I mean, it'd be great. But I mean, all human behavior has a J-shaped curve, virtually, except smoking, where there's no benefit. It's quite difficult with alcohol. When you look at the teetotalers, but you take out the alcoholics who can't drink and the ones who are dying of their cirrhosis and so on, it's much less J-shaped. And I'm just not sure that it's not more a reflection that moderate people do better than people with extremes of behavior in either direction. I'm not really convinced that red wine is any different from any other form of alcohol.
It's not the alcohol in red wine, it's the brain in it.
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know.
A last question? Or have we exhausted the audience? I hope we haven't exhausted you. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. And I'd like to present you with this medal of the Dixon clan. For your efforts this evening.
That's one. I didn't like to ask. I saw in one of the things that there was a medal. I was too embarrassed to ask if that was just 50 years ago. So.
Not at all. It's very much today.
Thank you very much.
So Thomas Dixon was indeed a senator. He was a master of complexity too. He managed several Ulster steamship companies, so the records tell me. And he was a businessman, but he went out to the fields and he looked after the cattle and was able to determine good meat, but also good vegetables. So he did adhere to the simple principles of healthy living. So he has set us an example there. So thank you again.
Oh, I'm very honoured. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm very, very happy.
Can I just in closing say thank you all very much for coming, and it's nice to see some younger people amongst the audience, and I hope that you might come back again in 2 weeks' time on the 24th of March. We're opening officially the Ulster Medical Society rooms downstairs. Professor Richard Clark is going to help in the opening of those and to unveil a bust of James McDonnell, who was the founder of the Belfast Medical School. The other thing I should say to you, there are some certificates of attendance this evening for your appraisal folders if you wish to have those, or a memento of the occasion at the back. And one other thing would be just to say there is a cup of tea, we hope, downstairs, or a cup of coffee to continue informal discussion. Thank you again for coming.